This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and we have our full crew again today. Welcoming back after a hiatus, our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, Katie.
And we have our chief critic, Rich Lawson.
Hello.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
We continue to be in the season that is not festival season, but festival announcement season. Since we recorded last week and talked about the Toronto lineup, the Venice Film Festival has announced their lineup, and the New York Film Festival is starting to roll out some titles, too. So we're going to get a sense of what's to come there. Joanna, you're freshly returned from TCA, right? You're not still in a Los Angeles ballroom?
I'm broken free from the ballroom. I am home.
Yes. So Joanna's gotten a big look at what's to come in television ahead. So she's going to catch us up on that. And then finally, we're going to swing back around to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Quentin Tarantino movie that we've been talking about on and off since Cannes, and we have all finally seen, which is very exciting. But first of all, let's talk about the Venice lineup. Richard, you'll be going to Venice this year for the first time for us, which I'm excited to see you on a gondola, like Lady Gaga last year just posed on the bow. What from the Venice lineup caught your attention?
Well, yeah, I'm really excited to go. I studied Italian in high school and college, which was incredibly impractical until now. I have professional use for it.
The long game there.
I think the big narrative for me right now coming out of Venice, and really, you know, kind of cynically speaking from like a work perspective, is like, it's going to be great to have a first review of The Joker out, you know, the Joaquin Phoenix movie.
Yeah.
That trailer, you know, because, like, there are going to be American journalists at Venice, but there aren't going to be that many.
Yeah.
And so just kind of, like, get a leg up on that. I guess, you know, we were talking about it, I think, last week. Like, I love the idea of a bunch of, like, snooty film festival critics weighing in on the superhero thing first.
Yeah.
Or the supervillain thing first and not, you know.
Are they going to ship, like, a plane load of sort of geek writers out there or something?
They should. Or they'll do a concurrent screening, maybe. Like,
right.
But I'm sure that, like, in order to get into the festival, they have to kind of be like, it has to be somewhat exclusive.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So, I don't know. And I think that, like, Joaquin Phoenix clearly, like, it's weird in a way that he doesn't have an Oscar yet. So I feel like that's an interesting narrative for a movie about, you know, a comic book character, though it seems to be a very different take on it.
This is a sequel to The Master, right?
I mean, essentially, I think it is.
He's drinking gasoline throughout.
The continued adventures of... but, you know, the fact that it's director Todd Phillips, who people mostly know as a comedy director, or he did The Hangover, he did Road Trip, that is the one thing where you're like, well, maybe this isn't actually going to be the thing. But then we said that about Adam McKay a couple years ago with The Big Short, although granted that's more funny, and that won Oscars, so...
Well, they always say it's easier to go from comedy to drama.
Yeah.
The comedy's so much more technical, so who knows?
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
Excited about it.
So that should be interesting. And I also think that, like, kind of rising to the top of the heap now, given that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood has been such a huge box office and critical hit, is Brad Pitt's next film, which is, you know, written and directed by James Gray, who did most recently The Lost City of Zed, which...
aren't you British?
Yeah, which we loved. And we had him on the podcast, so he's a really interesting filmmaker. This is a kind of a departure for him because it's, you know, a lot of special effects and it's, you know, a space movie. So I don't don't know. I mean, I have this theory that Brad Pitt, if they run him in supporting for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, would win the Oscar. And if he has another respected critical commercial hit in Ad Astra, that will only embolden that narrative.
Bradissance.
Yeah.
Ad Astra does seem like exactly the kind of movie, and I'm not just saying that because of my first man wounds, that is like technical and brilliant and critics love it, that gets zero Oscar nominations, especially because James Gray has made a lot of technical and brilliant and beautiful movies that have gotten zero Oscar nominations. But I think your theory is really spot on, Richard, that like Brad Pitt can get a supporting nomination for this huge hit he's in that's only bolstered by what looks like a pretty impressive performance in Ad Astra from the trailers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and so a lot of the Venice stuff that is also playing in Toronto. And I think, so I feel like we already kind of did talk about some of those titles last week, but I don't think we talked about, did we talk about The King, David Michaud's film with Timothée Chalamet?
I think that's a Venice exclusive. I don't think it's on the TIFF lineup, at least not yet.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. You know, it's a period piece with Timothée Chalamet. I mean, more of a period than the 1980s. Robert Pattinson's in it. You know, Michaud has been sort of up and down over the years. I think his last film was War Machine with Brad Pitt, actually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I loved his, you know, his first kind of breakthrough feature, Animal Kingdom. So, you know, I don't know. I'm curious about that, but really mostly curious about like the Chalamet of it. Like, how does he fare playing King Henry, you know, in the medieval ages?
Well, we all remember at Toronto last year when he was promoting Beautiful Boy, he had the bowl cut that he has for this movie and how completely nightmarish it looked on him. So I hope it pays off. He has such beautiful hair. Richard, how are you feeling about possibly being one of the few Americans who ever see Roman Polanski's next movie, which is going to be at Venice, but given the state of his reputation in Hollywood, may never get released here?
Yeah, especially now. I mean, it's a movie about the Dreyfus Affair, which, like, I believe it's the same Dreyfus that Julia Louis is a descendant of.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
But that topic is interesting. You know, it's called Jacques, you know, we know that phrase. But, like, I don't even know if I want to see it. Like, I don't really know what the sort of deal is right now with, like, can we separate art from artist, I guess. But, like, yeah, I think, Katie, you're right that there's a strong chance it just never even makes its way across the Atlantic.
Yeah, between reviewing that and the Joker movie, you might just need to delete your Twitter account once you leave Venice.
I also am reviewing a Scarlett Johansson movie, so...
Oh. Perfect.
Yeah,
storm.
I wanted to bring up Marriage Story because it's showing up in Venice and TIFF, and then it's going to be on the New York Film Festival lineup as well. And I am just like, from the very vague buzz that I hear, like, that's something that I feel like people are getting really excited about. Like, it's like Noah Baumbach's been on a really good streak lately, but this one seems to be, it's got more buzz than anything else I've been hearing about that people are maybe seeing early.
It's the only film, I believe, at this point that is doing all of the big four. It's going right from Venice to Telluride to Toronto to New York.
Huh. Do you know that it's in Telluride?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, because of the thing you explained last week about reading
exactly.
The tea leaves of the TIFF lineup.
Yeah. So, yeah, that thing seems to have some momentum. I've spoken to a couple people at Netflix who have the film, and they, you know, obviously it's their job to be upbeat about a movie, but like they still, you know, and I think Cam mentioned last week that he's heard good things. So that one, that should be interesting. You know, granted, Scarlett Johansson got herself in a little bit of trouble recently, but again, art from artist can be, you know, I think that like I'm willing to put aside that.
Surely she's not in a Polanski drawer at this stage of the game,
I
right?
So.
I mean, like,
no.
Let's, we can,
what a,
there
what
are
a
degrees.
Drawer to be
what
in.
A drawer.
Yeah.
But she could be, I'm trying to think, I know that there's been male examples recently of people who aren't necessarily like accused of bad personal behavior, but just can't stop putting their foot in their mouth on the press tour. And that's
is she in a
really
Liam Neeson drawer or not even?
I don't know.
I mean, Liam Neeson did do that
I
weird thing.
I forgot
like,
about
there was
the
some
Liam
behavior.
Neeson drawer.
Sorry to bring it up. I should leave it. Leave it.
I don't think we've had a woman in this position before in this age of kind of everyone's comments being kind of scrutinized by social media. And Scarlett Johansson's been really popular for a long time, and she's in the biggest movie of all time, and she's going to have her Black Widow spinoff. Like, she's so big right now that it will be really interesting to see what kind of, I don't know, media training she undergoes between now and when A Marriage Story opens.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing also, you know, going back to the Polanski of it all, it's interesting to have that coming so soon after Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And just like, feel like we're like reliving this 50-year-old thing with the same kind of cast of characters. It's just like an odd, I don't know, it's just sort of an odd moment for all of this. And I wonder if that means that the Polanski movie will get more attention than it would have normally.
Mm. Also, there's reviews of the Woody Allen movie with Timothée Chalamet that was filmed and then you know, it's scrapped from U.S. release that's apparently showing up overseas. So there's another weird part of the conversation that won't go away.
Yeah, right.
Speaking of, so Marriage Story is a Netflix movie, and last time Noah Baumbach made a movie for Netflix, it was The Meyerowitz Stories, which we definitely talked about and people were big fans of, but didn't seem to get a lot of traction awards-wise, I think partly because of the Netflix effect, which we've talked about a lot. And Netflix has a couple of other titles that are supposedly coming later this year, The Irishman being one of them. It's going to be the opening night of New York Film Festival. That's obviously a huge slot. But one of them that I'm curious if it's even still coming is The Last Thing He Wanted, which is a Joan Didion adaptation that Dee Reese is making. That seems like something that Netflix could stand to put on the festival circuit and kind of build the buzz for. And it makes me curious for yet another Oscar season of like what their strategy is with all of these hugely exciting movies that they're collecting.
Yeah, I mean, they have a crazy roster this year. You know, I know we're going to talk about also The Irishman, which by, I think by the time this episode comes out, the trailer will be live. I think that's coming out Wednesday of this week. You know, so it's not only a huge deal that like they've marshaled all the money and the technology to do this de-aging thing, but they've also, I didn't realize that this is the first time Al Pacino and Martin Scorsese have worked together.
That's crazy.
Which
that
is wild,
weird.
You know?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, you know, so I think all that kind of like, these are like, you know, three boomer icons in Scorsese and De Niro and Pacino all together in a like, nice, you know, meaty mob story about Jimmy Hoffa and you know, this hitman for the mob, like, plus the kind of prestigier aspects, plus it's opening New York Film Festival. And it's just like, that's such, like, everything about this is just like an absolute coup for Netflix.
Yeah,
but it's going to all hinge on how that technology lands with everyone. Like, I'm deeply skeptical of it. And I remember, like, Billy Lynn's Halftime Walk, right? Like, that had so much buzz, and then it landed, and everyone's like, ugh, the frame rate, I can't. You know what I mean? Like, there's a technological bomb like waiting to go off on this thing, and I'm really very worried about it. But maybe it'll be great. But I mean, like, if Marvel, with all their bajillions and all their technical wondery, can't, you know, like their de-aging stuff is good, but it's like good for like a cameo, and then you're like, oh hey, young Kurt Russell, and then let's roll on with the rest of the movie. But I'm really a little, I'm worried about it. I'm very worried.
So I was very skeptical at the beginning, and then as I heard more about it and realized that it really just fits in with Scorsese's sort of lifelong or at least late career thing of like, why should I make a movie if I can't do something weird, experimental with some technology? And then the kind of just the sheer sort of like, these old timers, like let's do one more show for the road type of a vibe. Like I'm now cautiously optimistic that it's, even if it has to be weird,
yeah,
but that it'll be fun and sort of, because originally I was just like, why the hell don't you just get some younger actors? Come on, guys. But right. I heard from somebody who, you know, is close to the production that in fact there people have seen, you know, versions before the de-aging happened, and that it looked pretty good, and that it was kind of, there was stuff where Scorsese was like to Pacino, you know, you got to get up those stairs faster, you're playing a younger man, like do it, you know. And so I think there's something kind of playful about the whole thing that is not necessarily reflected by the 100+ zillion dollar price tag of the movie, but you know, Scorsese has earned it, right, to do whatever the hell he wants at this stage of the game.
Absolutely. He can do whatever he wants, and I'm like, and I'm definitely going to see it, and I'm definitely sure there's going to be a lot to like about it, but in terms of it being like, I think it could just zap awards momentum if the effect doesn't land in the way, you know, the way that they're hoping it might. You know what I mean?
If it lands in the uncanny valley, then it's not going to be right.
Yeah. I'm also curious about the effect of most people watching it at home, because the way that it works with Netflix, like I'm guessing they'll give it a big Roma style theatrical release because it's Martin Scorsese and he values theatrical experience so much. But I wonder if the de-aging looks better or worse if you're watching it on your screen.
Yeah, I mean, de-aging plus, you know, all that motion smoothing and everything that is on HDTVs now, like who the heck knows. But something that's interesting about the technology that I'm told is that they weren't filming with, you know, ping pong balls taped, you know, with green things on their apparatus, you know, all that kind of like motion capture technology we think of. So I guess what you're seeing on screen with De Niro and Pesci and Pacino, all three, I believe, are aged down, and maybe Harvey Keitel too, it really is their movements, and they've just figured out a way in post to graft to do the de-aging that way without having to have the actors locked into this crazy equipment while actually shooting. So,
if your phone can make you look 80 years old at this point, like, you know, surely Scorsese can.
True. But FaceApp doesn't know how to make you look 80 and move. That's the difficult thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the one moment in Captain Marvel when Sam Jackson, who gets de-aged in all of Captain Marvel, and it's actually very convincing. There's just one point when he's running, and I'm like, oh, that's an older man. I see. You know what I mean? Like, you can't hide it in the run, I think, sometimes. So, yeah.
Yeah, but these guys, they're living hard in the period. They might have moved like a 70-year-old man when is it set in the 50s, 60s? I should do
sure,
my
Katie.
Irishman research.
Sure.
I'm already making excuse. I'm fan casting the Irishman. Do you guys have anything else that's on your radars that you're still looking for to show up of like titles that we've been looking out for? Like Cats, I think we all knew was not going to go to a festival. It does not seem to be the case, even though it's still the only movie anyone wants to talk about, as evidenced by Idris Elba's Hobbs and Shaw press tour. I've been keeping an eye out for the Chloe Zhao movie that she made with Frances McDormand called Nomadland that's from Fox Searchlight. I kind of thought it would be on one of these festival lineups, but it's not there yet.
That feels like they could add that to Toronto maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also curious about Noah Hawley's film, Lucy in the Sky.
That's the one I was about to say, Lucy in the Sky. It's my number one question mark, right? Where is that going to go?
Yeah, especially now that Natalie Portman's back in the Marvel franchise. She's in the top of the news cycle again.
Yeah, and I think it was confirmed to me that Little Women is not playing any festivals. It's kind of going the Phantom Thread route. But
that makes sense to me.
Usually there's like one or two movies that do that, but this year it feels like there's that. There's the Jay Roach movie about Roger Ailes and all the harassment stuff. There's Sam Mendes' huge World War I epic, 1917.
Which also has a Christmas Day release. All three of those have Christmas releases, right? So
there's a lot this year that could be sort of held for later. I mean, obviously AFI comes, you know, I think in November, and that usually premieres one or two things. I believe that's where The Big Short premiered, but it'll be interesting.
Is The West Side Story going to be in
next year?
Oh, that's next year.
They're filming.
That seems to be filming outside of the apartment of everyone I know in New York City. Like every weekend comes someone else who's like, they're here, they're at my house. They were outside your house, weren't they, Richard?
They sure were, yep.
Is it too early to take like a sort of, and maybe this is a all season long sort of question, but like a more holistic look at the way in which Fox Searchlight being owned by Disney now changes anything about strategy, or the way that Disney like being proximate to Fox Searchlight changes their strategy about anything? Because like obviously this is the awards feather in their cap that came with the acquisition of Fox, and I'm just curious to see if we see any changes as a result of that, or any movement from Disney as they got like so close with Black Panther, sort of like, I don't know. I'm curious, like now that Disney swallowed Hollywood, I guess is my point. What is it going to do to swallow the award season?
I'm extremely curious about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this year, maybe things were already kind of set, although this stuff actually happens pretty last minute. But, you know, they have Jojo Rabbit. They have Lucy in the Sky. They have Nomadland.
They've got the Terrence Malick movie.
They've got the Terrence Malick movie, like, which, you know, we shouldn't discount that film. I'm sure that's going to show up. You know, maybe New York Film Festival. But I think it's more for me, Joanna, it's a really great question. It's more like, what is next year going to look like? You know,
or
the year after. So it's not stuff that's already in production or wrapped, but like future acquisitions and all that. That's, I think, where we might see the change.
I'm also wondering about 20th Century Fox, the people who they inherited from there. And obviously there's been a lot of people who were at Big Fox who've been kind of pushed out by Disney. So it's not like it's all of the same people. But, you know, they've had more recent, you know, they had Bohemian Rhapsody. Like there are people within Big Fox who I would think Disney is hanging on to, who know how to run an awards campaign in a way that Disney hasn't in the past. So I'm curious if maybe that filters into a campaign for the Avengers movie, and like my pet theory that Robert Downey Jr. is going to get a supporting actor nomination. But I do think, Joanna, that's like maybe the big question of you know, award season power players this fall.
And I just thought I'd get it out of the way. I thought we'd solve it in July. Did we not solve it? Okay. Well, keep an eye on it then.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Okay, Joanna, you have spent the last week or so kind of hearing all of the biggest pitches from the biggest players in prestige television. Casey Boyce of HBO came to TCA, which is the Television Critics Association panel, meeting, whatever.
Summer press tour.
Yeah, there we go. So you kind of got the best sales pitch for all of the biggest shows that are coming out this fall. So what got you the most intrigued out there?
Yeah, I should clarify that I was only there for the cable portion of it, and they have moved, because of actually the Disney acquisition that we were just talking about, they have moved FX deeper into the network schedule, because FX usually is like next to Fox's day, but now it's also next to ABC's day, so it's sort of like just that growing mass of power over there with FX. So I was not there for the Landgraf state of, the State of the Union that John Landgraf usually gives. He has not given that yet. So our eyes will be on that later this week. But I was there for HBO Day, Hulu Day, Amazon Day, et cetera, et cetera. And Casey Bloys was sort of the big, before they tried out these panels with their upcoming shows that they're excited about, the brave executives of certain TV networks do something called an executive session where an executive comes out, sits in a chair, and everyone in the audience gets to ask them, like pepper them with questions. And on like a particularly scandal-ridden year, like an executive will sit it out, or there are many reasons why an exec will sit it out. And Casey Bloys sat down from HBO in front of everyone. It was just like, I'm ready, bring it to me. And it was so clear. Like, there was one year he came, I think it was the Confederate year. He came, he was sort of like one of his first executive sessions. He came and he was just not ready. And it did not go super well.
And now Confederate is not happening.
Everyone was sort of like salivating because like there was the Big Little Lies scandal. There's like the HBO finale scandal. There's like all this sort of stuff. And everyone like, this is it. And he came and he sat down. And he was just he was super ready. And like, whatever you might make of his answers, like someone would start asking him a question and he looked like just like the brightest A+ student, just like so ready. He was like, yes. Okay. Yeah. I got this one. All right. Yeah. Big Little Lies. Here's what I have to say about this. Or like someone's like, so the finale, he's like, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. So glad you started with that one. I have this one memorized too. Like, but he did, like good naturedly. And then later, they had this big splashy Warner's, entertainment party, later that night with all the talent, a bunch of like wrestlers were there, but also like HBO stars and stuff like that. And Casey Boyce just like came and sat down and talked to three of us for like 40 minutes. No, it wasn't that long, 20 minutes. I don't know. And he was just sort of like, woo, how did it go? And we were like, you did pretty well. He's like, who else are you going to grill? What's next? And we were like, oh, you were it. You were the main course. He's like, oh, I like when the other ones get grilled. Like, that's so fun. So that was an insight to me that the other execs are like watching each other get like roasted at the TCAs or whatever. So, but yeah, I mean, HBO Day was pretty impressive because they've got Watchmen, His Dark Materials. We got to see early looks at both of like the first episode of both of those upcoming series, which are big sort of crowd pleasery. Well, His Dark Materials might be. I'm curious about how Watchmen lands, even though it's a comic book adaptation of a very, very popular comic book. It's still Damon Lindelof going like maybe even a little weirder than The Leftovers, which I'm just really excited that HBO let him do. It's very much my stuff, but I don't know, how the wider tastes will feel about it.
How did it get received at Comic-Con? Because you were covering it when it premiered a big trailer at Comic-Con as well, and that seems like the audience that might, you know, instinctively say, like, this isn't the Watchmen we know, but it seems like it went over better.
Oh, I think people were really excited because what they cleverly did, you know, Lindelof is calling this a remix, not like a reboot or even a sequel, even though I would call it a sequel. He's calling it a remix. And what they held back for a long time was exactly how many characters from the original were in this. At first, you only thought it was one character. But when they released the trailer at Comic-Con, it was revealed that a bunch of characters like Dr. Manhattan or Silk Spectre, I'm sorry, please don't nod off awards people as I start mentioning comic book character names, but Regina King's in it. She's amazing. She's the lead. She's incredible. One person in the TCA audience brought up a question because it deals with, surprisingly, it deals with a lot of very sensitive white supremacy, race relation, the police force, sort of like all of those topics are what he's most interested in. And it's because Lindelof said, you know, Watchmen was written in the 80s and it was responding to like what was happening in the 80s. That's what that Watchmen was about. This Watchmen is about like what's happening now. And this seems to be the thing that's happening now that seems most worth questioning authority and, you know, vigilantes and stuff like that, is this idea of like white supremacy and racial relations, stuff like that. And so he got some tough like questions from the audience about the way it was presented in the first episode. And I think it'll be a little bit of a wait and see, but he's not shying away from sort of tackling that. So that should be interested. I'll be interested to see if like there is such an extreme reaction to the first episode that he doesn't get a chance to, you know, prove himself later on. But I'm really hopeful.
Is Watchmen going to be a series or is this just a one-off?
A series, I believe.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Robert Redford's president. I don't know if you guys have picked that up from the thing, but that's a really interesting thing. I don't know if Robert Redford's actually in it, but they use his likeness.
You mean the guy from the GIF?
that guy from the GIF. But in the original Watchmen, they've done away with term limits, and so Nixon is still president in the 80s. That's one of the conceits of the original Watchmen. And so this follows actually one of the later comics where Nixon dies in office, Ford takes over for him briefly, and then Robert Redford beats him in like the 92 election or something like that. And so Robert Redford has been president from 92 till now. And the question is that Lindelof said he was interested in like pursuing was, what are the long term effects of a well-intentioned, like rich liberal white guy in office? And like, that's interesting because it's not going to be like, it's not a utopia. So like, what are the downsides of that? So I don't know. I'm really interested. I got Katie excited because I told her there's 3 full numbers from the musical Oklahoma in the first episode.
Yeah.
So Don Johnson has a beautiful singing voice. So who knew? I didn't know that. So,
and we're expecting Watchmen in like October roughly. They haven't announced a date, right?
I think they said October.
Okay, yeah. Great.
They didn't say a specific date, but in October. So yeah. And then I'm not sure about His Dark Materials, which is an adaptation of the Philip Pullman book, Lin-Manuel Miranda, James McAvoy, et cetera. One important concept from that story is that everyone's soul sort of exists on the outside of their body in the shape of an animal. I know this is high fantasy, folks, but the special effects were not done on that. So we watched like a bunch of pre-viz, like little animals running around, which was like sort of interesting, but I'm really, really intrigued by that. But that's sort of, you know, HBO is following the Thrones lead into like more genre, more literary adaptation, which seems to be sort of like what everyone is interested in. But in terms of the show that TV critics were most excited about, that has to be Modern Love, which is an Amazon series, which is from John Carney. And it's an adaptation of the Modern Love column in the New York Times. It reminds me a lot of like Paris Je T'aime or New York I Love You, you know what I mean? It's like a bunch of little, Anne Hathaway got in trouble, I guess, for calling it a short film, her installment. Or it's like the Romanoffs, you know what I mean? Except less connected. But it's like a bunch of little short films, little love stories based on these columns. And it's just like, it's just beautiful. And it's like Dev Patel and Kristen Milioti and Tina Fey and John Slattery and all this sort of stuff. It's just like, it's like perfect catnip for TV critics, and they just ate it up, and like people were openly weeping watching their screeners and stuff like that. So that's one that I don't know how it'll do with like the mainstream, but in terms of like critical buzz, that feels like another big win for them after Fleabag was such a huge win for Amazon earlier this year. So
in the general vibe you got from being here, and like we've been asking ourselves the post Game of Thrones question for television as a whole since May, is the state of the television union strong, Joanna?
Well, something really sharp that Emily Vandervoof said to me, TV critic for Vox, while I was there, was like, that's actually a question we can maybe put on the back burner, because let's be real, the show we're all going to be watching for the next 2 years is like the Trump/election show, oh, right? God. Like that's the next Game of Thrones, to be honest with you. And then we can figure out what comes after that. But like, is the state of the TV union strong? No, I mean, like something I say every year when I go to TCA is I think when I started going a couple of years ago, it was like the tail end of like the heyday in terms of like, I don't know, excess of publicity and like glitz and glamour and pushing things like that. And it just keeps stripping back and stripping back and stripping back, which works better for me because I get uncomfortable with like the amount of swag they hang out and stuff like that. Like, I just think it's a little excessive. But like, I think with the diminishing returns on like trying to get every single show to pop, you can't get every single show to pop. You can hardly get any show to pop. So like, you have to, and there's so much content that you just have to spread your resources a little bit thinner, I think, if you're a network. And so you can't just like come and just put all of your push behind these three shows when you're HBO and you've doubled your output. You know what I mean? Like, you've got half as many resources now. I've heard behind the scenes, what I heard is that HBO is scrambling, not because they're like, oh shit, Thrones is over, but like, at least the publicity team, they're like, oh God, all this content we have to push out. Like, I've heard it's absolute like chaos over behind the scenes at HBO in that regard. And like, you wouldn't know it necessarily based on, you know, like the huge Emmy success, Chernobyl, great hit, blah, blah, blah. But in terms of them adapting to this new normal of, I don't know, just adding one extra night to their lineup has put them in a bit of a spin, is what I've heard. So yeah, it's TCS is a really interesting place to hear a lot of gossip. Yeah, a lot of things.
Was there anything at TCA's about Apple Plus?
No.
Interesting.
And that's why Apple Plus did like their own thing. So,
but we still don't know when any of those shows are coming, right?
Allegedly, the morning show is supposed to come before the end of the year, isn't
it? Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
God, this is like, because Disney Plus is launching in November. This is, and then this is gonna be a really crazy fall for TV.
Here it
on
comes.
Top of all of these movies we just talked about.
Get ready.
Too much content.
Get excited.
Yeah, I was talking to someone the other night who works at Rotten Tomatoes, and we were at like a kind of a movie event together, and she was like, I can't believe this is all starting. And I was like, no, it's exciting. Like, I love the fall stuff. But now that I'm thinking of like huge upheaval television narratives happening at the same time as like our, you know, regular Oscar stuff, it's like, wow, that's quite a bit.
You're going to miss Love Island so much from this period where there's nothing else to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
So now we're going to get into our conversation about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is really chock full of spoilers. So if you don't want to be spoiled on the movie, I don't know, just we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, so as promised, we want to talk in a little bit more depth about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Quentin Tarantino movie, which, as we mentioned, is a huge box office success. It really does feel like the first movie of the summer that people are, like, really talking about and really diving into. Mike, you saw it, I think, last night, maybe jumping on, like, after we've been hearing people talking about it, like Richard at Cannes for months. So when you finally got to see it, how did it stack up to what you were expecting?
Well, I had kind of admittedly kept my mind as clear as possible from stuff in advance. So, you know, I obviously saw this and that, but I didn't have huge expectations of anything either way. And I confess I was kind of going into it thinking I just have to see this to have seen it. I wasn't like that psyched about it in certain ways, which maybe was good because I found it really enjoyable, delightfully. It was just delightfully unapologetically Gen X in its sort of like, I mean, I really do think it's kind of like a middle-aged fantasy of just being allowed to age gracefully without a bunch of fanatical young people around, or if they do come around, you just blow them away. And as, you know, as problematic as that may be, it was, I found it enjoyable, and I sort of like was like, Brad Pitt is in this movie, is like my spirit animal right now. He and Leo are so good. You know, like, there's plenty to argue about, but I think just it just has such a great vibe. It just has a good pace. It's like it rolls along, but it's actually really meticulously constructed when you think about it later. You spend the next, you know, I think, you know, it lodges in your mind and all kinds of things come back to you. You think, oh, that's why he did that. That's why he had that move. So I don't know. I think it's probably very different being a 44-year-old, frankly, white guy watching it than if you're like a millennial watching it going, what's up with this weird movie? Like, I just found it hilarious. Like, to me, it was just like one long kind of great joke in a way.
This is my new favorite take on this movie. It didn't even occur to me.
That it's Gen X?
No, that it's like Tarantino being like, young people,
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's the, like the scene where the hippies walk across the street and Leo's like, oh, fucking hippies. And you're yeah.
No, I mean, when he comes out there and yells at them in the car to get the hell out of my property, I was just like, why am I like cheering
holding a
in my mind
margaritas
for this?
Yeah, it's like the dream.
That just connected a piece for me. Yeah, I also saw it last night and having like tried to dodge spoilers fairly successfully for like a week, and I didn't love it as much as Mike. I liked it. I think it's trying to be a little too much movie, I think, and there I would disagree a little bit with like the meticulous thing. There's just some stuff that felt like a little sloppy to me, like the way some of the flashbacks were done or the way like some famous people were labeled and other people weren't. I'm like, why don't we be consistent? Why don't we do consistent like Kurt Russell narration or consistent like IDing these 70s icons or whatever?
Or Damian Lewis as Steve McQueen just explaining all the characters in the scene.
Why not? Why not do like a big short thing and like cut to Damian Lewis in a hot tub being like, you see, like this person loved this person. But having listened to all of Karina Longworth's You Must Remember This series on Manson and Hollywood twice, which I never re-listened to a podcast series, but I did for that. I was fascinated by like the Spahn Ranch stuff, which is stuff that I was familiar with. And then What Happened Night Of, which is stuff that I'm like very, I'm not like a Manson like freak or whatever, but the specific intersection of Hollywood and fame and Manson and what about it particularly irked his followers. Like, I really think Karina Longworth owed royalties off of this film. So I thought that was interesting. But what one of the elements of the discourse that I have found interesting that I've like tried to soak up in the last 24 hours is this question of like, was Tarantino obligated to inform perhaps younger viewers a little bit more about the Manson family? Because the ending is fairly violent. Not fairly. It's extremely Tarantino over the top violent at the expense of these Manson family members. That's the spoiler that, you know, is coming. And in the same way that Inglourious Basterds, you know, it takes revenge on Nazis, or Django Unchained takes revenge on, like, slave owners. But for some people, maybe the Manson family isn't coded as automatically evil, though I think probably they should
be, or it's a little more complicated, but they're not, it's not like Nazi bad, slave owner bad, young hippie girl equally bad, you know, like young hippie, misguided hippie girl or whatever it is. And so like to see those girls get their faces bashed in or what have you, I'm like, these people did unspeakably evil things. And so perhaps they should be coded as evilly as those other institutions. But like, would it have helped if Tarantino had shown a little bit more of that for people less familiar with the murders? I don't know.
Because there are people who think it's gratuitous amount of violence toward women specifically.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't know. I was cringing at the violence, but not necessarily the genderedness of it, but just sort of like, it was just a lot. It was a lot all at once, and I don't usually consider myself that squeamish, but
I feel like this is part of why I'm like, enjoyed it being unapologetically. That's why I said unapologetically, yeah. Gen X. Yeah. Like the whole point of Tarantino is he's going to go way over the top, yeah, with crazy, absolutely, violence and profanity and all kinds of screwed up stuff. And in the old days, in prehistory, you know, the whole idea was like, are you hip enough to like get through this and sort of be in on the joke and realize that it's all a big spectacle? And now it's become, you know, how like politically coded is this? And that's fine. It's a different world. But I don't know. It feels like quite a quibble to be like he should have better explained what the Manson family was. I mean, if people don't know what the Manson family is, like they need to be, as Dennis Leary once said, to bring up a problematic comedian, like, you know, these people need to be worrying about low flying planes.
Right.
Quite possibly. I'm saying I'm not convinced that that's right. Let me be clear. I'm not convinced, right, that that's correct. That's just like an argument that I've seen that I've been like chewing over. Like, is that... Like I'm just wondering how much my familiarity, my extreme familiarity with the situation helps me absorb the story, and like trying to figure out what it would be like to go in not knowing. Yeah. But the story.
It's supposed to be, I mean, it's problematic as hell. Like everything, like Brad Pitt seemingly maybe killed his wife, yeah, in this movie. Like these aren't like good guys or anything. Right. There's no heroes. It's just like another wacko revenge fantasy from, you know, the diseased but sort of brilliant mind of Quentin Tarantino, yeah, right?
I mean, I think that I think an interesting facet of not necessarily how much Tarantino needed to explain the kind of, you know, dramatis personae, but I don't necessarily 100% agree with it, but Richard Brody at The New Yorker wrote a really interesting kind of like counter-narrative review, as he often does, of this movie and kind of its politics. And I think that like when we're talking about the hippie stuff, this movie has like a million possible reads, and I like yours a lot, Mike, about how you saw it as this kind of just like permission to just kind of be like, like kids, blah, you know, right, like that's fun. But I think that with them being hippies in particular, the movie could be seen as doing a bad equating of hippies as a broader kind of idea with Manson people and maybe the people that Didion writes about in Sojourn Toward Bethlehem. Because, you know, hippies were essentially an anti-war movement and were, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theory that the Manson murders were orchestrated by the CIA to discredit leftist, you know, young, youthful political ideology. So I'm not saying I come down on any sort of way about that. I just think there's an interesting political dimension to the movie, as well as the personal for Tarantino, the personal for the viewer.
Well, I agree. And I think that My read, which could be totally wrong, is that Tarantino is in on the joke of being like, holy shit, I'm a middle-aged white guy. Like, mm-hmm, why do I relate to like a washed-up, pathetic Western guy? Why am I afraid of left-wing young people? Why do I think they're going to hurt me and I want to hurt them? You know, like I think Tarantino is enough of an artist to be like, there's something brewing here that I don't particularly like. It was way more fun to be the angry, cool young person, but here I am. Hmm. I'm a slightly washed up, like weird middle-aged white guy. You know, what is that like?
Yeah, and I think in support of your point, Mike, is
Cam and Richard alluded to this last week, but like I was fully not prepared for the feet in this film. And the feet, the like, you know, this has long been a joke about Tarantino that he has a foot fetish and he puts a lot of like foot shots in his movie. But this was like so over the top that it was just sort of like, yeah, I fucking heard what you said about my foot fetish. Here you go. Here's Margaret Qualley's like smushing her feet up against the windshield. Like, you know, it's just sort of like, I get it. I know what you think of me. Here it is. You know what I mean? Like, I think that supports your point, Mike. And I like that. I like that reading a lot. Another reading that I really like, a friend of mine, Lindsay Romaine, who writes for Nerdist, she's like one of the most Manson / Sharon Tate obsessed people I know. She had a great point about that boat scene, about that question of like, did Brad Pitt character murder his wife? And so the question then becomes like, okay, if he did, like it cuts away so you don't know necessarily. So if he did, then can we see like Leo's character as sort of like a Tarantino enabling a Weinstein sort of figure, you know, whoa, like a bad guy, right? Or can we see Tarantino himself as the Brad Pitt figure, you know, because he had his own like sort of scandal around like the way in which he treated women on his set and stuff like that. Not same drawers to allude to Mike's thing, separate drawers here, but like similar questions, like who is Tarantino in all this? And what does, whether or not Brad Pitt's character killed his wife, either he killed his wife and he's been let skate by in Hollywood because Hollywood, it turns a blind eye to these things all the time, or he didn't, and he's someone who's like in need of a righteous sort of redemption sort of thing. I don't know. It's interesting to me that boat scene is left as a slight question mark, and how that changes the reading of the film.
It also seemed like a Robert Wagner reference, just
absolutely,
very basic
Hollywood.
Sure. Which is not, I don't know how the real Robert Wagner would fit into a story like this, but you know, you see like husband wife boat mystery. I put my mind there. It's also really interesting that he's got this like Hollywood mocker character played by Al Pacino, and I thought Al Pacino was so great in this like two scene role as Melvin Schwarz, but that he's not. That's not really a Weinstein-y figure at all. Like, there's no, even though it's a movie about Hollywood, Tarantino doesn't seem to be grappling with Weinstein in any real way, which he didn't have to, but I might have expected a little bit more of it.
Well, Polanski's in this movie, you know, like that's
with no lines at all.
It's weird to have Polanski in the movie. I don't know. It's just, it's interesting.
I don't know how you could have not had Polanski in the movie. I think the amount of Polanski in there is about as much as you could get away with.
Well, and the other thing we should probably mention is this question. This other scandal is like, does this film do right by Sharon Tate? And I would urge people to read our colleague Julie Miller's interview with Sharon Tate's sister, where she talks about like how she felt about the depiction. Like Margot Robbie's character of Sharon Tate does not have many lines in the film. And there was like a question at Cannes that sort of sparked this whole conversation of like, you know, sidelining the murder victim in her own story or whatever it is. But I think some people have made some good points about the fact that, like, I feel like I know Sharon Tate more from this film. Like, there's this long sequence where you get to see the actual Sharon Tate, like, in a film. I've never watched a Sharon Tate film. I feel like this movie is more interested in me knowing who she actually is than any other sort of treatment of the murder that I've seen before. You know, like,
I would agree with that completely.
Well, and it is interesting to take her out of the tragic, to erase her tragedy, right? And then correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Polanski get into all of his crazy trouble after she died? And some people thought that it was a possibly sort of whack, like really crazy grief reaction. So you're even left to sort of be like, the only kind of reference to Polanski is like that Polish prick or whatever they call him. Mm-hmm. But you're even left to wonder, like, maybe in this fantasy world, Polanski actually like doesn't do those horrible things and isn't a fugitive in Europe for the rest of his life. Like, it is a, it's an interesting kind of delusional. I would agree with Richard. I didn't really want to read that Richard Brody thing because it just, he comes to it with this moralism that I find irritating. But like, I don't think you can deny that it's a fairly reactionary vision. Like, let's face it. Right.
Yeah.
It's like it's celebrating to, you know, like, middle aged white dudes.
And
who
I think
are just
that's
like, fuck it.
What's catching people off guard is a reactionary kind of conservative movie from Quentin Tarantino. Right. Like, he's like the enfant terrible, you know? And it's like, well, he was 25 years ago, but you know, he's now in his mid-50s. And you know, I think, Mike, I would love to think that Tarantino is that sort of, not just self-aware, but sort of like, almost like therapeutically minded, that he wanted to work something through, you know, in making the movie. I think his reaction to the question at Cannes about Margot Robbie's lines indicated to me that maybe he hasn't been like paying attention to the world, but like maybe he has. I don't know, you know.
No, I mean, the other thing is, you're right. Like artists make stuff because they want to make it, and it's the best thing they can think of to make. And I guess probably in a perfect world aren't assessing the whole time the political implications of what they're doing. So that's left for us to do.
I do want to clarify. I think that Roman Polanski, though not as extremely bad, like had done some like questionable behavior before, like before Sharon Tate's death. So it's not just like that her death sent him tail spinning into like, but you're right, like what if is a great question to ask at the end of this, and that's like what that overhead shot at the end is. You're like left to think like, okay, what if. And I like, I'm glad that Richard brought up Joan Didion, because I was thinking about those Didion, like the Didion essay on like what the Manson murders did to Hollywood. So if you strip, if you take the Manson murders out of Hollywood, out of like, out of the flower power movement, like, cause that like it was already souring, the flower power movement, but like the Manson thing is what like really cemented like hippieism as like a threat. And if you take that out, if you take their murders out, then like, what does, you know, I want the next chapter. What does the rest of the world look like?
Yeah. Does without Altamont the Manson murder?
Now cancel Altamont.
Get reelected. Yeah.
Do the Beatles erase from history? No, I'm just kidding. That's a different movie. But like, you know, like I'm like fascinated to wonder, like, you know, what Hollywood specifically and what the world looks like without the Manson murders. So I don't know.
I wanted to get into the Leonardo DiCaprio of it all, because Mike, you were just talking about this idea of like, you know, having sympathy and like reflection of someone who reaches middle age. And I think DiCaprio is such a sympathetic avatar for that thought. Like, it's the last time he was in a role, it was The Revenant. We spent so many months of Oscar season rooting for him to finally win an Oscar. And he started off his career as these kind of like scrappy strivers. You think of Romeo and Juliet or Titanic, and has since spent so much time being like, you know, doing accents and playing like tough guys and schemers. And I think of this role as being low status, like this guy who's kind of insecure and like really relying on Brad Pitt to help him out. And we haven't seen him in that mode in such a long time, which makes him so sympathetic, I think, especially when you get to the end and he finally gets like his invitation up to the top of the mountain to go to Sharon Tate's house. It gave me so much affection for him that I've always, you know, been a DiCaprio fan, but I felt like I hadn't been that interested in him as much lately. Yeah. And it sparked so much for me of what he can still do, and so much just meta thinking about his career, which I think is really definitely part of the text of this.
Well, Tarantino's so good at casting and at giving them roles that sort of, I feel like, resonate in interesting ways with their lives. I mean, the Brad Pitt side of it is so interesting. First of all, like, always give Brad a character who's like not very intellectual and like on drugs.
Yes.
Like, that's always a good idea.
Burn after reading.
Sorry. Yeah. And then Leo here. Yeah. Like Leo is obviously not washed up in any way, but like Leo's getting to the period of time when his full on prime is probably, you know, like is coming to an end. And so to anticipate that in a way with this role, and also play the alternate universe where instead of becoming the biggest movie star in the world, he was like a fine star who kind of then like had to go to Italy to like crank up his career, is really fun. And you're absolutely right that vulnerability makes him likable in a way that it's been a long time, I think, since you were rooting for Leo. Yeah, I mean, we rooted for him, like you said, for The Revenant, but even then it was sort of like, it was like rooting for, you know, General Motors or something. Like
for the Yankees.
Yeah, here you're really kind of like you feel for the guy, and yet you also can see that he's ridiculous. And I give Leo credit for like taking on a role like that. I mean, it's I don't think you have to be that difficult to kind of put yourself in Tarantino's hands, I guess, as a male actor anyway. But it really comes together. It works.
Well, he does comedy so well. I'm watching both him and Pitt do the comedy mode. You know, like, I love Leo and Django Unchained And I was like looking at his filmography to be like, okay, when's the last time I felt like Leo was vulnerable? He's vulnerable in The Great Gatsby. That just happens to not be a great film, but like he's giving like a pretty good like you feel for the guy in Gatsby performance. But you're right. I mean, like there is something very special about this, especially like him beating himself up on the set of this like dumb Western that he's making.
Yeah. Or the first scene, he's crying over what he's just been told by Pacino's character.
I think it's also interesting, you know, to think about DiCaprio being, you know, 4 years post-Oscar. This is his first thing after he won an Oscar for, like, a real labor of physical, you know, intensity. Because, you know, I think it's not really 100% true, but something we talk about with people who win acting Oscars is actresses get it at the beginning of their career, actors get it either at the end or, like, comfortably in the middle of their career. And so what did that Oscar confer on DiCaprio just as he turned 40? Like, you know... So to have this role, this, you know, hurting, still really, really desperate for creative, you know, fulfillment, but also kind of fatalist about the whole thing, to be his role right after the, I mean, not right, 4 years after the Oscar, like, that's an interesting kind of psychological mapping of, like, where he might be right now, you know?
Yeah. And there's something about, sorry, full spoiler, we've obviously been spoiling the shit out of the movie. The flamethrower is a very interesting, like, symbol to me. Mm-hmm. This and that's what I'm thinking of when I think about it being meticulously constructed. Like, there's such a funny scene where you see him training with the flamethrower, and he's like, you know, it's really hot, and the guy's like, it's a flamethrower. to him having that be his instrument of sort of really screwy heroism, that it's from one of these kind of trashy movies that he made. It's a prop. Like, it's pathetic and also triumphant at the same time. It's really it's interesting.
And it's the fact that Emil Hirsch, when he shows up with J.C. Marino, he's like, 14 Trials of McCluskey. Like, everyone knows that trashy movie. It's like, what a great title for a fake World War II movie. Yeah.
Should we talk about Margaret Qualley in this movie and how great she is?
So great.
She's so good.
So good. That's all. she's having a really good year, right? She's great in Fosse Verdon, reportedly. I've already said on this podcast I didn't watch it, so I'm not going to pretend I watched it. But, like, reportedly really good
nomination.
In Fosse. Yeah, really good in that. Really good in this. It's, you know, great in The Leftovers, which is a show that Mike Hogan had to convince me to stick with. So, like, you know, three cheers for her.
Well, she's a good counterpoint to the idea that it's entirely anti-hippie, because she is a really appealing character. And then, obviously, she, you know, you get to Spawn Ranch, and the sequence at Spawn Ranch is so good, too.
So
and
tense.
She kind of turns, but I do, like, she kind of does something to at least let you see the appeal of hippies before, you know, it gets into the murdering them.
Well, she's a siren, right? I mean, pretty much straight up.
Yeah.
Right, and Manson had, there was a girl, I think, called Kitty Cat. It's not one-to-one, but there was, like, one of the youngest girls that he would, like, who was attractive, who he would send out to lure people to the ranch. So that's, like, sort of her jab, I guess. Yeah.
I had completely forgotten Lena Dunham was in the movie, and then when she showed up, that was a little jarring. For all the great casting in there, I was not prepared for Lena Dunham. Yeah.
Lena Dunham was in two films at Cannes.
Wow. Austin Butler was really good as Tex, and he's an actor that I've been, like, waiting to see what casting directors have seen in it. Like, he keeps showing up a thing, and I'm like, that guy? He's going to be playing Elvis in the upcoming biopic.
Oh, right, right.
But, like, yeah, you know, I've seen him in a bunch of projects, and I'm like, the kid's handsome, but I don't get it. And then I saw him in this, I was like, oh no, he could do something. All right, I'm interested. So
I think Lena's presence supports my theory that you can map the millennials to the hippies in this thing, and Gen X to the silent generation.
Yeah, there's something pointed about that.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess so. Oh well.
But yeah, Mike. No, I agree. Joanna, Austin Butler's interesting. So he and Lena Dunham were both in The Dead Don't Die, the Jim Jarmusch movie, and this. Lena's part in The Dead Don't Die is, like, even less than a cameo. It's very short. But yeah, I think Butler has something intriguing about him. Now, like, can we talk about, like, the Oscars of it all? Because, like, I had mentioned, I think at the top of the show that if Sony decides to run Pitt in supporting. I feel like the narrative of not just the like in the movie, but also that, you know, just Pitt in general, like, he's never won. I feel like that's a strong thing. I feel like screenplay, clearly, that seems to be where Tarantino usually lands. But, like, I was talking to somebody in LA, I think, where they were like, well, this is the first Best Picture nominee of the year.
Yeah.
Like, for sure. Unless you count Endgame.
Or The Farewell. If The Farewell gets into, like, a...
Right.
Broader
right.
stuff.
I think yeah. The Farewell is worth considering for that too. But
yeah.
But like this feels like, guaranteed.
This is 100% Best Picture nominee, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially with the box office. I mean,
yeah, just the box office. Yeah.
Brad,
yeah.
You got Brad Pitt and Leo in the two
and it's about
leads, Hollywood. And it's about
to
Hollywood.
Some extent.
Yeah.
And Timothy Olyphant. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, he's great. The third biggest star in America.
He's great.
I think Leo will be nominated for if they run him lead, right?
Yeah.
And Brad could really win.
I think there's a good case for supporting for Brad. Like, I get that people would say it's category fraud, and I think it probably is in spirit a two-lead movie, but, like, that supporting nomination wouldn't bother me at all.
It's so perfectly set up because he works for, he supports, Leo's character. Like, for some reason, even though it shouldn't be that way, it totally does work that way in your mind where you're like, that's a supporting role. Mm-hmm. He supports Leo's character.
He's supportive, right, exactly. So, I don't know, I think it could be interesting and... You know, it's hard to kind of call those things this far out, but like I feel like last year, we kind of knew Black Panther was going to get in there, or we had an intuition that Get Out was going to. So I don't know. I feel secure.
Like the summer. Dunkirk's kind of the, like the summer model that's closest to this.
Yeah.
Maybe
I feel secure in saying that movie will get nominated for like at least 4 Oscars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's also got, it's such a big production. Like, you think about the production design, the costumes, like, it can rack up nomination totals in that way, which helps when you're a summer movie trying to kind of stay in there when you're being considered in so many categories.
I think, I could see Margot Robbie for supporting. I don't know. I mean, I understand the...
she's very good.
The nonverbalness may make it seem like it's a less significant character, but I think she had a ton of presence. Like, it's a good... She's just so good.
I thought she was extremely good in it. I would, even Margaret Qualley, supporting. Why not?
Bruce Dern.
sure. And one thing I want to mention before I forget is maybe to speak more to Mike's interpretation of this is the number of children of famous people who are in this
movie. Yeah.
Like, because Margaret Qualley is Annie McDowell's kid, obviously. Rumor Willis is in this.
Maya Hawke
is in it. There was another one, just like a few, like down sort of in the bottom of the, you're like, there's a bunch of like daughters of famous people in this. And I was just like, it felt like a intentional casting decision.
And the daughter of two of my college friends is in it, but they're not.
What?
Oh, really?
Yeah. One of the Manson kids.
Or even just seeing Dakota Fanning as Squeaky Frome. Like, she's on the title, but she's been famous her entire, Harley Quinn Smith.
Oh, Harley Quinn Smith.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I thought Dakota Fanning was so scary, so good. I don't know.
Yeah, she was really good.
Luke Perry last film, right? It's like lovely to see Luke Perry. Nicholas Hammond, one of the Von Trapp children.
Wait,
in there.
What?
Oh, so, yes, yep.
Yeah, Friedrich plays Sam Wanamaker. So,
what? That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I like Tarantino movies.
I like how we've settled on, man, Tarantino knows how to cast a movie, like inalienable fact. Zoe Bell showing up for her one scene I loved.
She was fantastic in her one scene. Loved her.
I mean, I guess the Bruce Lee scene is a whole can of worms, but I enjoyed that scene immensely. And I get that people want to debate it and think it might be problematic, but I liked it a lot.
I mean, and it might be. And I think that's a valid interpretation of it. I think it was, I loved the other Bruce Lee scene, which is like, it's true. It's factually accurate that Sharon Tate trained with Bruce Lee to like, for that role that she did. And so to see her watching her movie and then thinking about training with him for her fight, her like dumb little quick fight scene in that movie, I think that's a really beautiful way of like showing her taking something that's so like silly. She plays the klutz, right? Something so silly, so seriously. She trained with Bruce Lee for like
for a Dean Martin comedy.
Yeah, this dumb 2-second fight in a Dean Martin comedy. And that is like, that's just like a beautiful, true grace note about Sharon Tate. That's like nice to have in there. So, and maybe that's a reason why that whole scene exists in there. Brad Pitt's character is not supposed to come out of that Bruce Lee interaction like looking like the good guy. I mean, it's true that I get the reasons why people are upset about that scene. And I think that's valid, honestly. But
yeah, point is to show that Brad Pitt was like a slightly unhinged nut.
A loose
very
cannon.
Deserved to get kicked off the set of the Green Hornet.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so that does it for this week's episode. But before we wrap up, I just want to tease a little mini project we'll be doing throughout the month of August as we kind of wait for all these big festival movies to premiere. We're going to do a Little Gold Men book club and talk about four books that are going to be the basis of movies that are coming out this fall. We'll have the full list of titles on Twitter on our Little Gold Men feed so you can start catching up. But next week, we will be talking about Little Women, which is going to be the Greta Gerwig movie coming out at Christmas. So if you want to start catching up, go pick up your old copies of Little Women. We'll be talking about that next week. And hopefully it'll be a good way to prepare for the fall season ahead. As Joanna knows, being a smug book reader is never a bad way to be, even when it comes to movies. So please join us.
And well, we do want to say, like, you don't have to read every book in order to, like, listen to the episode.
No, of course not.
I think we're going to, you know, we're starting with Little Women, which is a lengthy book, so we're not like, hey, in a week, read Little Women. But
read the Wikipedia page of Little Women and then
join us. I think one thing we will want to talk about is whether or not it feels like one should read the book before seeing the movie in each case and stuff like that. So, like,
definitely
making the case for reading the book or not and stuff like that. So, yeah, join us. We'll be talking about it. We'll be spoiling Little Women, which that Friends episode did many years ago, so hopefully you know how it ends.
All right, so join us next week for that and everything else. In the meantime, you can find us at vanityfair.com. There's lots of great writing about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood on vf.com right now, so please read it. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. And Richard?
Rylos.
And Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
And Mike is at Mike_Hogan. He had to run. This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best title for Mike Hogan's upcoming spin-off podcast goes to Mike Hogan.
Unapologetically Gen X.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.